Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. I'm Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. On today's interview, recorded September 14th, 2021, I talked to Janine Lassaletta, who's researched the psychological effects of nostalgia. One of her research findings is that when people are feeling nostalgic, they care less about money. They're more willing to spend it or give it away. And this can help explain why we see so many companies use nostalgia and retro elements in their marketing and product packaging and such. So Janine and I talk about that and what the factors behind that are. And we talk about people's desire for authentic experiences and products and brands and what authenticity means in that context. And we talk about the desire many people seem to have for old-fashioned, traditional pastimes. And we talk about how all of these things may overlap a bit and how they're related. I got interested in this topic recently, thinking about how a lot of people seem drawn to activities associated with nostalgia or old-fashioned or traditional or even ancient concepts. To give you just a few examples, this would be things like people getting into old video games or video game systems, getting into making one's own soap, getting into raising animals or butchering one's own meat, getting into winemaking or beer making, getting into beekeeping, getting into ancient paleo or caveman diets, getting into Eastern medicine, which has a much more ancient tradition than Western medicine. Then you've got all sorts of products and experiences that market themselves using nostalgia or using elements of tradition and ancientness and such, even when they don't have much to do with those things. These are just a few examples, and to be clear, I'm not denigrating being drawn towards such things. I've just been interested in how and why old-seeming things can be attractive. And I have an interest in existential psychology, which theorizes that much of what drives our behaviors is related to a few core anxieties that are likely to be present for all humans: fear of death, fear of meaninglessness, fear of isolation, fear of freedom. And so I'm interested in how nostalgia, or a longing for the past, can represent various ways to relieve such anxieties. A little more about Janine Lassaletta. She's an associate professor of marketing at Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University. Her research has focused on how nostalgia affects consumer attitudes, behaviors, and choices across varying contexts, for example, politics or health. Her work also examines the motivation for money, product choice, and hedonic consumption. Her research has been published in the Journal of Consumer Research, Journal of Marketing Research, Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin, and Food and Quality Preference, and has been featured in multiple media outlets such as BBC, CNN, Fortune, NBC's Today Show, and Forbes. She also has a blog at Psychology Today, which you can find by going to psychologytoday.com and searching for her last name, Lassaletta, L-A-S-A-L-E-T-A. Also, maybe of interest, towards the end of the podcast, we talk about some other things, including a little bit about politics. We talk a bit about Trump's Make America Great Again slogan and how that can relate to nostalgia, and about how nostalgia research might be harnessed by political or governmental communications. We talk about using nostalgia to influence or manipulate people. We talk about the Danish concept of hygge and how that may be related to nostalgia. We talk about other psychology research Janine has done related to what's called hedonic consumption. With that work, she studied what it is that makes people tired of having the same foods, and strategies for making people continue to enjoy the same foods, even when they have them over and over. Okay, here's the interview with Janine Lassaletta. Hi, Janine. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So maybe a good place to start is defining nostalgia. How do you define nostalgia?
I define nostalgia the same way the New Oxford Dictionary of English does. In my work and the work of my colleagues, we define nostalgia as a sentimental longing for a personally experienced past.
Would you say that that can be nostalgia for something in your own life, or can it be outside of your own personal experience? Can it be like history?
So that's a good question. So there's two main ways that nostalgia has been defined in the literature. And one is the first way as a sentimental longing for a personally experienced past. It means a past that you yourself have experienced. Mm-hmm. So for me, I could be nostalgic for the, and I'm kind of nostalgic sometimes for the 1980s or the 1990s. But according to this definition, I could not be nostalgic for the roaring 20s or the dirty 30s because I was not around for that time. So I could not personally experience it. However, there's another definition of nostalgia or conceptualization of nostalgia that is by Holbrook and colleagues. And basically, it's a preference for anything that was from a past or from the past. It could be personally experienced or it could be historical nostalgia. So there's also work in historical nostalgia, which is also quite interesting. But in my work thus far, I've primarily been focusing on personal nostalgia. And for it to be personal, it has to be something that you had experienced personally yourself.
Can you talk a little bit about your work on nostalgia and consumerism?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was thinking about or looking for a dissertation topic, one thing that I noticed is there was a lot of nostalgic or retro styling in stores, etc. So I really love aesthetics and how things look like. And I would notice that, you know, every so often, Hershey's might have a throwback wrapper for their chocolate bar, or I was in Minnesota at the time, and General Mills every so often has like throwback packaging for
sodas. Do that,
yeah. So yeah. Absolutely, like a Pepsi, you know, in particular, Pepsi would have a throwback Pepsi soda with the older packaging, and also the older formulas where they use real sugar versus I think corn syrup. Those are things I notice in the marketplace. So I was wondering, why is nostalgia? It seems to always be used, or it was used so frequently in not only marketing products, but also promotions. Sometimes, you know, there's this, I can't believe it's not butter promotion. I don't know if you remember it. It was an ad and they were, I forget the name of the family, but you know, it was a family from like the 60s or the 50s. So I was wondering why it was used so often. I was thinking, well, maybe one reason nostalgia might be so successful in marketing is that it makes people spend their money more easily. That's how I started on my nostalgia work.
And you did several studies demonstrating exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so many studies. I think people that are not in this academic domain might not realize that we run so many studies to, you know, make sure that our effect can be replicated, that our effects can be replicated using different conceptualizations or operationalizations of what our dependent variable is. In other words, when I did my nostalgia and money work, not only did I look at the overall theme or the overall hypothesis was that nostalgia decreases the desire for money. And by that, I meant the desire to have money, to earn money, to hold on to money. So I looked at things like people's attitudes towards money, how important they think it is, or in some other studies, I endowed people with actual money and observed how much they gave away if they were nostalgic or not, if they're in a nostalgic condition versus control condition.
What do you think the psychological causes are behind that for thinking of money less important?
When I was looking out at, you know, in the marketplace, I saw nostalgic was prevalent not only in products, but promotions for products or for brands, etc. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, one reason that nostalgia is so prevalent is because people are less motivated to hold on to their money, right? Their desire for money is less. I was thinking, well, how can that be so? I'm like, well, money is so important for us as a society because we use money in exchange for goods and services, right? But if you think about it, we don't always have money, especially when we're younger. I think about times, you know, when I was a graduate student as well. If I moved, you'd ask your friends. Or if I went to a conference and came back, I'd ask one of my friends, you know, to pick me up from the airport because I didn't have money then. So we can access these same kind of things through the help of our friends and family or through money, right? So people that are completely independent, they don't need to rely on other people, theoretically, because they can get everything they want with money. Like even you can get companionship with money, right? Kids, they don't make money, but they're fed, right? They're, you know, they have fed, they have clothing, etc. Money's not as important to them because they can access these goods and services. I don't think they think about it this way, but they can access goods and services through, you know, their social support and social connections. So
less existential anxiety around having to perform. They're less stressed about surviving. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So I thought, well, maybe when we're nostalgic and because, you know, we're filled with thoughts of close significant others and we feel more socially supported, money might not be as important because we have the sense that we can access these goods and services through, you know, connections with other people versus having to access them through money.
So you also had a study about being reminded about friendships had a similar effect on making people more loose with money. Is that right?
Do you remember what experiment that was?
With Friends Like These, Who Needs Money?
So that's a project that it's still not published yet. It's still underway. But it takes the same idea, right? It looks at not just social support through nostalgia, but just feeling socially supported itself. Mm-hmm. Does feeling socially supported, does it offset, in a way you can think about feeling socially supported offsets the need or the desire for money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I read about your work, and maybe I'm just phrasing it differently, but the thing that pops out to me is when people are reminded of meaningful things, like the things that actually matter in life, like their friends, family, their experiences, you know, it just makes us get out of that more competitive kind of rat race mindset, a bit like our day-to-day life. We're focused on money a lot. We're focused on making it. We're focused on getting by and the stress of that. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, I think I'm saying the same thing, basically, that people feel more at ease when they remember that, oh, I have a social network and I have these meaningful connections. So I'm less worried about money and I'm more likely to spend it because I'm focusing on what's really important in my life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. It might be a little bit of a different take on, you know, the substitutability between or the offsetting money versus social support as a means to get things. But I do agree that when we think about our friends and our family, we kind of shift onto intrinsic kind of rewards or values or motivations. That's a better way to put it. So I think when we don't think about our friends and family, we're more extrinsically motivated. You know, we want to get that money, right? We want to get that, you know, that paper, mm-hmm. or we want to become successful. But when you think about friends and family, it will shift it towards a more extrinsic kind of motivation or reward system.
Yeah, I think we're talking about a similar thing. But yeah, I see it might be just a different angle or focus. A small note here. I did afterwards realize that Janine and I were talking about two very different ideas here. That might be obvious to people listening, but I did want to throw in that I did afterwards realize that we were talking about two separate things. That definitely rings a bell for me when I'm, you know, when I think about the past or friendships, which seem very related because your positive memories are often about friendships and the experience you've had with people. It makes me think like, oh, why am I so worried about money? These things don't matter. I mean, yeah, just on that narrative kind of aspect about it, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
it's definitely compatible, right? Because in my work, I look at how priorities change when people are nostalgic, and what you're saying is also priorities change when we think about our friends and our family.
Does anything stand out as being a really surprising finding in your research where you were like, oh, didn't expect to see that?
Not necessarily surprised, but kind of surprised that, not surprised, but I'm pleasantly surprised that the nostalgia effect, this is what I call it in my dissertation, that when people are nostalgic, their desire for money decreases, so their motivation to have, hold on to, or make money decreases. That works not only for people's attitudes, but we actually gave people money. And when people were nostalgic versus not, they actually gave it away, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, we endowed people with $4.75, you know, in there were two different conditions, an ordinary life condition or a nostalgic condition. And each condition, people had to think about a past event. The difference was in the ordinary life event condition, it was just something, you know, an everyday kind of thing. And the nostalgia event condition, they had to think about, they were given the definition of nostalgia, a sentimental longing for a personally experienced past. And then they had to, you know, think about a nostalgic event. And in that condition, they played this game, which isn't really a game. It's like a one-shot game. It really doesn't seem like a game. It's called the dictator game, where there is someone that is endowed with an amount of money, and they have to decide how much they're going to keep for themselves and how much to give to the other person. And that's the end of the game. They gave them $4.75. So everybody in the study, they thought they could either be the person endowed or the person receiving. And they had to pick, it's like classic psychology experiments. They had to pick a slip from the hat that says which role they did, but all the slips said they would be the one that would be endowed with the money. They had to decide how much they would keep themselves and then put how much they wanted to give to someone else in an envelope. And we found consistently that those in the nostalgia condition gave away more money. It was really cool to see that happening. It didn't make the final published version, but it was in my dissertation as well. We played a public goods game where people were in teams and they had to decide how much they were going to put in. There's say four players and everybody's endowed with, like, we didn't have this much money, but like $10, and they have to decide how much they want to put into this communal pot. Mm. And then that pot gets multiplied by like maybe 1.5 or two. So it's in the best interest for everybody to put as much money as they can in the pot. And then it gets equal, like whatever the pot is, it gets equally divided by the players. But there's also a selfish component. You could just keep that $10 for yourself, right? And not put any and still get, like, still reap the benefits. We found that when people are in the nostalgic condition, they put more money into the pot. So they gave away more money at the beginning. So it's really cool to see it happening. I don't know, and it's in so many different ways. So we have different, we call them operationalizations of desire for money. And one was, you know, one was the dictator game, one was that public goods game. Another operationalization was asking people's attitudes about money. Mm. One really cool one was that I asked people, I gave them a snippet of, like, I for some reason had sound effects from, like, I think a Sony sound effects CD set. It was a long time ago, a CD set. And there were these horrible, horrible sounds. Like, I think there was like a car crash and like someone playing the violin really poorly, a rooster, etc. And I gave people a snippet of each of them and I asked how long they would be willing to listen to them in order to get $5 or something. Mm. I don't know the exact amount. And the logic was that the longer people would endure something horrible for money means that they want money more, right? It's like when you think about in like a different situation, I will line up for this free, which I have in New York. There's a free scoop of ice cream for like half an hour, right? If I didn't care about the ice cream, I wouldn't. I mean, that's a different resource. But what I found was the same thing, right? So people that were in a nostalgic state, they would not listen to it that long because it wasn't that important to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, also willingness to pay for products. People were willing to pay more when they're nostalgic because the logic was, if you don't care about money that much, you'll more easily spend more of it. So we found that when people are in a nostalgic state, by and large, across, you know, durables, non-durables, high-end, low-end products, experiences versus, like, you know, products you can hold in your hand, people were willing to spend more when they were in a nostalgic condition. It was very cool that we saw, or that I saw, the effect across many different types of operationalizations of it.
Do you think this was known by companies even informally, like the fact that, like, a company like Pepsi or Coke or whatever would notice that when they did retro nostalgic things, their sales went up? Do you think it was well known in the industry, even if they hadn't, like, specifically studied it?
I suppose it was well known enough. I would see it so often, right? Why would you have the throwback every so often, right? It's not only just one time, right? So
it's almost like they didn't need to study it because it was so obvious for them that they got results. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like it wasn't broken. So, you know,
just keep doing it. Yeah. And you mentioned, I think you mentioned in your paper, maybe it was someone else, but you mentioned the nonprofit implications of trying to raise funds for charities or whatever there could be. You know, you could do some psychological influence there by using nostalgia to your benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, nostalgia is very easy to implement because everybody is nostalgic about things. And, you know, you can even just write nostalgic, you know, with a question mark. And, you know, even there's stimuli from one of the studies in my work, and it was done a while ago. So it was for Kodak. But we just used a picture of a family, and we asked people to think about memories from their past or think about memories from the future. And even though the picture wasn't of them, of course, eventually you can prompt them to think about their own past.
And are you saying that even just the word nostalgia can make people nostalgic?
Yeah, I think it can. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even
it's like shortcuts to our feelings. Yeah. One random thing that I just thought of is I was thinking about how casinos might make use of this. And it struck me that there's a lot of casinos in Vegas and elsewhere that have a really old fashioned vibe. Like they haven't updated their stuff in a while. It looks really old. And I used to think that was just because they were lazy or didn't want to spend the money to update. But now I'm wondering, like, maybe that's a purposeful thing to kind of look kind of throwback. Like you haven't changed.
It could be. Yeah. I think about the Riviera or something. Is that the Riviera? That's just,
Yeah, there's a few in Vegas where I'm like, this looks really old. Like why didn't you do more with this? But, you know, if anybody's thinking about how to loosen people monetarily, it's the casinos. Yeah, and the reason I've been interested in these topics is I sometimes think about how the desire for nostalgia or more authentic or old-fashioned seeming experiences can be a way to combat existential angst and existential fears of meaninglessness or fears of death, things like that. And as the modern world becomes more, seems to have produced more loneliness and stress in that regard. You know, there's polls showing that loneliness has increased over the past few decades and disconnectedness. So I've been interested in how those things relate. And I'm curious, do you see a connection to, you know, the stress of the modern world and our desire for nostalgia or authenticity or whatever it is?
I definitely see it. I was talking to someone else about this the other day, and anxiety and interruptions in our day-to-day life. People are more lonely these days. These are all things that would make nostalgia more attractive to people, right? Nostalgia, even though, I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but initially nostalgia was used to describe like homesickness as a disorder, right? That, you know, something that caused pain. But what more and more research is showing is that when people feel a decrease in social support or when they don't feel so good about themselves, they feel like their life is meaningless, they turn to nostalgia. So it might be spurred on spontaneously, or they'll be drawn to nostalgic things. So I think, you know, definitely, we see it a lot, right? During the pandemic, there's so many, you know, throwback Thursdays or flashback Fridays, or, you know, like half the new content on Netflix is reboots of old sitcoms, right? Like Full House, or I don't think this is on Netflix, but there's a new Wonder Years coming out soon, etc. So I think nostalgia, I think, is also, it's been, they always say nostalgia is at an all-time high, but I really do think that nostalgia is, you know, in fashion, but it always is. I mean, I think because we don't always feel good all the time, right? And I think now I think there's more of a reach for nostalgic things because people are under duress. The same thing with, you know, maybe looking for authentic experiences. I think authentic experiences and nostalgic experiences as well, or waxing nostalgic as well, this authenticity brings a sense of meaningfulness or continuity. If it's something authentic, it might not be something that, this is a little bit different than nostalgia, but, or it overlaps, but it's not entirely, you know, 100% overlap with nostalgia. Authenticity, doing something authentic, is kind of meaningful because it feels real, you know, or there's a tradition of, you know, X, Y, and Z, and me doing it makes, you know, me feel more authentic. And that makes me feel good about myself, or makes me feel that I'm doing something meaningful or participating in something meaningful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe this is a good part to talk about that, that link to the desire for authenticity and the desire for nostalgia, because they do seem very much related to me, right? The, like you said, it's the desire for something real, and you can perceive, you know, the past is more real than the present because it's closer to the source of something, right? It's like, we know that the present is us just reacting to things, and it seems like it could go many different ways, but the past is closer to something, or seems closer to something real, in the same way that our nostalgic experiences seem more real or closer to the source. Yeah. Maybe you have some thoughts on the link between authenticity and nostalgia.
Could you unpack a little bit why you think, or, you know, the reasoning why being authentic is more to the source, or like, or the past is more to
that's a good question. Cause it's, I don't think it is obvious. Cause I was reading a lot of studies on, you know, like not your stuff, but like studies about the desire for authentic experiences and authentic things, you know, like there's a study showing that, not surprisingly, that when you're shown a painting, if you're told that it's an original Rembrandt or whatever, you appreciate it more. It actually fires off more appreciation things in the brain than if you're told it's a copy. And so we desire things that seem more real, close to the source, authentic, and you can kind of perceive the past as being, well, especially if we talk about like modern life being more artificial, right? Like we've created all these artificial experiences. The things we do in our day-to-day lives become more and more artificial in the sense that people are creating our experiences. And so the past seems more authentic because it wasn't a human creation, right? There were experiences that were more natural, or at least seemed more closer to, you know, the old days where we didn't have these artificial experiences. So I kind of see them all kind of linked, you know, whether it's nostalgia or appreciation mm-hmm. of an original painting, or appreciation of like the, you know, a draw towards these like cavemen diets, or, you know, wanting mm-hmm. to make our own beer, or wanting to, you know, make our own wine, whatever it may be. It's mm-hmm. like we want something that isn't, you know, hasn't been polluted by humanity or something, right?
So the authentic experiences would be, or so on the flip side, what would be something, you know, you were saying that presently there's all these human made experiences that are not so authentic. Could you give me like an example of that?
In the modern world, many of us live in cities or towns where, you know, we go out to the store, we might go spend a significant amount of our days in artificial environments, whether that's stores or homes or buildings. And then we watch mm-hmm. artificial experiences in the media, you know? And so it's kind of like that, the Solaris thing, like the movie Solaris was all about the artificiality of our surroundings in the modern world, and our craving for something that seemed more real. So that's mm-hmm. that's what I mean. It's like in the old days, there's the perception that we were less part of that human made creation and closer to something that was more real, you know, but I guess basically nature. You know. A quick note here. One thing I meant to mention here was that our past can seem much more real and authentic in the sense that the past is more innocent. It has less artificiality. As we get older, we learn more about how to manipulate the world and how to manipulate others. And when we were young, we were much less skilled at those things. So in a similar way to how we can view the modern world as increasingly artificial, we can view our own selves as becoming increasingly artificial over time. That's another way I see nostalgia and a longing for simpler times as being connected. Back to the interview.
You know, so the question is the overlap, what I think the overlap is, or the parallels between people craving nostalgia versus and people craving authenticity?
Yeah, and I think you kind of answered it already. I think you basically saw a connection there. And would you agree they're similar attracting forces, basically, like when people are attracted to, you know, old-fashioned ways of doing things, whether that's farming or getting back in touch with the land, or Eastern medicine, even mm-hmm. things like this. Do you see a connection there between those kinds of draws and our draw towards nostalgia?
I think, you know, in both cases, people are trying to find something more meaningful, right? And mm-hmm. you know, I think about, you know, everybody was making sourdough, right? Or mm-hmm. I remember mm-hmm. at one, like during the pandemic, or one point, me and all my friends, I don't know if you saw it, but you can like repot scallions, you know, in mm. water, and it will regrow. So we were all doing that. And I think, you know, in a sense, it was giving us some we were also probably bored. But bored also, you know, when people are bored, that also, there's some research that has shown that when people are bored, they feel more that their life has less meaning, right? So mm-hmm. we're doing these things, and maybe these things that are more authentic, and to get some type of meaning back into our lives. So I think, you know, they're similar on that level.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you've hit it, because that's what I was thinking about. I was thinking about how what really ties all of this together is just people not wanting to be bored and not wanting to feel like they're not doing anything meaningful. And so whether it's nostalgic experience, or whether it's a, you know, something that's perceived as some traditional experience, whatever it may be, there may be many other things, but they all fall under the umbrella of we just hate the idea of stagnation and meaninglessness. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. we're looking for ways to accomplish that. Yeah. So I think you've hit what's going on there pretty well, in my humble opinion. and another interesting thing I think about the tradition, you know, following traditional mm-hmm. things, like people, you know, whether it's sourdough, or, you know, making your own soap, or, you know, things like this, these mm-hmm. traditional things. It's, I think there can be a sense of calm there too, because it gives us a guidebook of things to do, of things to follow. We don't have to decide, you know, I don't have to decide something new or something less tested. It's like we're following in the footsteps of people, and by putting tradition on a sort of a pedestal like that, it has a calming influence. Do you think there's something to that too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think traditions are, you know, in themselves are meaningful, right? And I agree that, you know, when there's a tradition of doing a certain thing in a certain way, it decreases a lot of ambiguity or decreases our anxiety about what we need to be doing in that moment or how we have to prepare something. I was thinking about, so this past Christmas, I wasn't able to see my family. My family's in Canada and I'm in New York. And, you know, I was thinking about the traditions that we have, and I did them here in New York, and I was probably nostalgic for them. And I was lonely because I wasn't with them, and it just made things a little better mm-hmm. because they're meaningful. And I think many of our traditions that we learn are through our families, right? And through our friends, right? So, you know, altogether, I think they really can help people in times of, you know, stress or duress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, might be getting too philosophical, but it's like that. There's that terror management theory of how yeah. many things we do are, you know, to abate our sense of existential terror. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that theory's gotten a lot of criticism, but I can really relate to that in my own life. Just that it feels like the things that draw me, you know, are things that abate, that they kind of attempt to eliminate my fear that things are meaningless or, you know, that there's the abyss, so to speak. We're drawn to these things that seem to set us at ease a bit in mm-hmm. that regard.
Yeah. Or to buffer it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's work, you probably come across it on nostalgia and terror management theory, right? Mm. Where nostalgia acts as a defense in the face of existential threat.
I haven't seen that. Okay, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's the terror management function of nostalgia. It's Claire Routledge.
Oh, right. Maybe I did see that because that name rings a bell. Yeah, okay. Anything else stand out that we haven't covered that you wanted to mention?
You know, we're talking about authenticity, and what makes somebody authentic is like being true to the self, right? And acting like themselves across different situations. Or when you think about, you know, what makes you, it can be your hobbies or things you do outside of your work, or even your work, you know, to some extent, or probably to many people's extent, but they don't want to admit it, yeah. right? But, you know, when the pandemic hit, all of these things were disrupted, right? So usually I have a running crew uptown called We Run Uptown, and I would meet with them every single Monday, basically almost when I moved to New York a couple of years ago. And that was something I did. And I'm not a fast runner, but, you know, I was a runner, right? And this was kind of like my crew, my group that I'd see once a week. It was something meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. But when the pandemic hit, nobody was getting together anymore, right? And other things I would do, I would just do small things, just go shopping downtown or go to the Green Market, which I think kind of stayed open, but, you know, I was too afraid to do those things. So mm-hmm. when we had all these disruptions, I kind of lost the sense of what made me, and I was drawn to more nostalgic things. I would listen to, you know, I really love 90s hip hop. I don't know if it's on anywhere, but I used to be a hip hop director at a radio station, and I had an underground hip hop show for several years, which is still on in some way, shape or form 20 years later, which is very weird. And so I would listen to a lot of hip hop, mm-hmm. you know, these things that made me, I felt less authentic, and I felt less like, maybe not like explicitly less authentic, but I did not feel like myself, you know, mm-hmm. in this time. I also went back to nostalgia. I would watch nostalgic shows, or I would listen to nostalgic music.
No, yeah, totally. I think, you know, I think the way that COVID disrupted people is really not understood. I think people focus on the financial aspect, but there was such an, even if you were doing well financially, it's like there's an existential disruption there, looking for meaning that wasn't there previously. I mean, I know people in Portland, especially in Portland, Oregon, you know, where we've had a lot of good amount of violent stuff and mm-hmm. riots and things like that. I mean, I personally know people that they were not like that. They were out there, you know, doing those things, and they were not like that a year before. Like, they changed substantially. And I think there was, mm-hmm. you know, for a lot of people, you know, I'm not, that's just one example, but I think a lot of people went through a disruption of their sense of meaning. It's like, oh, I had this plan for what I was doing, and then I cannot pursue that anymore. And especially for younger people, I feel like that's, mm-hmm. that's very disruptive to feel like, oh, I've got this plan and now I am adrift, you know, don't know what to do with myself. And yeah, I think that's underappreciated, I feel mm-hmm. like, and not to, you know, in no way am I giving excuses for the January 6th stuff, but I feel like that's a factor for some of those people too, in the sense that COVID's been very existentially disruptive to a lot of people. And I feel like if if COVID hadn't been going on, I don't think things would have, some of the things that happened over the past year would have taken different forms, I think.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. I think, you know, a lot of us are, we're bored, you know, and kind of trying, and when we're bored, we're trying to find meaning. And there are these opportunities that were there that, you know, people could kind of reassert what their meaning is, right? Be it protesting in the streets against racial inequality, or I guess protesting at the Capitol to try to assert or engage in the values that were consistent with that.
Right. It can almost be a violent thing in the sense that if your, you know, continuity, your sense of self and your goals get wiped out, it's almost like you need to look for something quick to replace that. I feel like that happened to a lot of people where it's like, I quickly need something very strong to reestablish my sense of meaning, you know, and I think that can be kind of a violent shift for some people.
Absolutely. When people, you know, people were threatened, I think to an extent we're all threatened, right? And not only by the virus, right?
But everything.
But also, by everything, you know, so there were so many threats to the self. So I think it's a prime time for nostalgia, which is, you know, a way that,
a comfort.
Yeah. It's a comfort. And, you know, and I think it's a good way to just like, you know, I'm not feeling so good. Why not indulge in these things? And, you know, there's not really harm. If anything, it will motivate you to reach out to your friends and family, right? So I think nostalgia is a great way of battling these things. And I think that one thing that's great about this nostalgia research is that by and large, nostalgia does so many great things for people. That's what we found so far. And even though you might think it's a little bit sad, and it is sad, right? There's a bit of longing. Yeah, it's bittersweet, right? But the sweet, it outweighs the bitter so much, right?
Do you see a connection to the Danish word hygge, or however you say that? You know what I'm talking about? Do you see a connection there?
I'm not so familiar with hygge. I know that's like, I only know it in terms of design and aesthetics. Can you explain it a bit more for me?
Well, I'm just reading the Oxford Dictionary definition. It says a quality of coziness and comfortable conviviality that engenders a feeling of contentment or well-being, regarded as a defining characteristic of Danish culture. I don't know much about it myself, but it just suddenly occurred to me, like, it's kind of like it's almost like a place version of nostalgia. Like, presumably you'd have to have some nostalgic feelings to have a feeling of contentment about about coziness or a sense of place. Mm-hmm. So it kind of struck me that it might be very much connected, just another form of nostalgia almost.
Yeah, there definitely could be some type of overlap, right? I think hygge, when I think of it, I just think of like people with socks on in front of a fireplace or something, right?
Right, I guess it's a feeling, it's not necessarily a place. I might be misspeaking there, but I guess they have things that they describe as like a place, like a room is embodies hygge or whatever. But yeah, probably just related in the sense that they bring a sense of comfort.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Is there any other psychology work that you've done that really stands out as something you're proud of besides the nostalgia work?
There's another project actually about nostalgia that was published earlier this year, which I guess this could also go underneath like surprising findings. We found in a series of experiments that nostalgia actually increased healthy consumption and decreased unhealthy consumption. The theory was also grounded in social supports. We thought, well, maybe nostalgia might influence healthy eating behaviors because if we think about close friends and family, it makes us feel socially supported. And there's this work, not my work, but this body of work that shows when people feel more supported, that this increases self-control. So people, you know, will better control their urges to eat something unhealthy, or they'll eat more healthy things. Mm-hmm. So nostalgia can be seen as a self-regulatory force. We had students come in. They either wrote about a nostalgic event or an ordinary life event. And once again, these are both events from their past. After, students were given a small bag, and the bag either had peanut M&Ms or they had baby carrots. And we found that that was a nostalgia condition. They ate less M&Ms and they ate more carrots compared to those in the regular condition or in the control condition.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. It's getting at kind of the stuff we talked about before where, you know, memories and connection give us meaning and protect us against worst case scenarios. And, you know, it's kind of like why abuse and trauma and those experiences are so sad, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they set people up to not care about themselves. You know, like you, when you have connections, when you have good experiences, it makes you care more about yourself. And then, yeah, I think that's kind of getting at the heart of it there. Yeah.
Sometimes people think, you know, because I'm a marketing academic, that all the stuff that I do is like, oh, about nostalgia and money, you know, or just trying to get people to spend their money, you know, and, you know, or we're trying to get firms to be richer, et cetera. But
manipulate people. Yeah.
Yeah. Manipulate, you know, and I used to teach in France, and I taught this class about, I don't know if you're familiar with Bob Cialdini's Influence.
Oh, yeah. I love that book.
Yeah. So I teach. So actually, the half the course is me teaching Made to Stick, you know, Chip and Dan Heath, and like how to make sticky messages so people remember them. And the other half is Bob Cialdini's. And I just teach them the principles of influence in France. I'm like, oh, it's influence. Mm. And they're like, my friend's students were trying to translate it. They're like, oh, manipulation. Like, no, right. It's not necessarily manipulation, right? But this work and nostalgia and money can, and you mentioned it earlier, it can be put to good use, you know? If you want to elicit donations from people for a good cause, I feel like this is something that, you know, people can use. And it also has been demonstrated that nostalgia can be used for charitable donations. One thing I was thinking about though, Zachary, is that the social component about nostalgia, when we think about our friends and family, this could be something that can be used to enforce, you know, different, so I also don't know how political people are when they listen to your podcast, Zachary, but it can be used to help, I don't want to say enforce, but help, you know, or
persuade.
I don't know what the word is. Yeah, persuasive, you know, persuade people to wear their masks or to get vaccinated, you know, or to, you know, to do or socially distance, to do these things that it's been so hard for us, mm-hmm. hard to implement. If we think about keeping our family members safe, you know, we also talked about how priorities shift when we're nostalgic, right? So when we're nostalgic, we might care about money less and friendships more. Maybe we care about our personal freedoms less and the collective or like our, you know, collective health more. That could be something. I don't know. It hasn't been tested, but, you know, given that nostalgia leads people to put, you know, social connections at the forefront and remind us of friends and family at the forefront, that might be helpful for the positioning of getting people to wear masks, right? Or getting people to be vaccinated.
That totally makes sense. It's like the map over from, if you're not caring about money, you're also presumably not that greedy in other ways and you're more collective mm-hmm. Focused. Yeah.
I think that, you know, these things can be used for the greater good.
Getting on the political tangent, mm-hmm. interestingly, when I was listening to things about nostalgia, there was all this, some of the interviews touched on the so-called dark side of nostalgia and, mm-hmm. and would mention the Trump campaign and the Make America Great Again mm-hmm. slogan, which interestingly enough is, to me, there's nothing that offensive about the slogan itself, because you can imagine it pertaining to like the fact that America has lost its manufacturing base and mm-hmm. seems to its middle class has suffered a lot, things like that. So for me, the focus on the, you know, seemingly negative interpretations of the Make America Great Again thing, well, obviously, you know, Trump plays a role in the negative associations, but if we're just talking about the slogan. Oh, and the other interesting thing about that too is Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton both at one point used the Make America Great Again slogan for themselves. That was an interesting detail too. And if they had used it, presumably they would have focused on, you know, the high points that Democrats mm-hmm. perceive, you know, the fact that we lost our manufacturing base and looking back at the better times when there was a stronger middle class, things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So to me, that the focus of that's necessarily just a bigoted view of the past or a longing for some, basically there's very negative interpretations put on that, which I don't think necessarily have to apply just based on looking back fondly on American history. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say too, it kind of makes me think of, you know, it seems like Democrats could use those kinds of things more in their messaging, where it's like, it shouldn't only be conservatives that own looking back fondly or nostalgic messages. There's definitely a space for those messages. But I don't think, you know, as we've seen, I don't think I feel like Democrats or liberals in general have kind of rejected that fond looking back at the past due to the fact that conservatives seem to have claimed it, which I don't think needs to apply. I think you could have, I think people of all political spectrums can find ways to look back fondly at certain things. And as you've shown, there can be positive, persuasive aspects to that. But anyway, a long soapbox there, but I've been thinking about those things too.
Yeah. I have work and, you know, we hadn't published it in about, you know, what kind of messaging is more effective for Democrats versus Republicans. And I think it reflects what you said too. It's kind of nuanced because thinking about the past, but thinking about what from the past, right? You know, so I think.
Yeah.
So, I mean, definitely both parties can be nostalgic, but it's about what. And I think when I think about the Trump campaign, he's telling you, or the campaign's telling you, what are the things that we, you know, American, I'm not American, by the way, but what things you should be nostalgic for. And I think that resonated with that particular, you know, segment, right? So I think it would be interesting. And I think it would be interesting to see what type of nostalgia would attract both sides. You know, if you wanted somebody that was Republican to switch to, and, you know, vote for, you know, a Democrat, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's what gets me about it is like, I think if you were to ask the average Trump supporter what that meaning of that phrase means, mm-hmm. I think it would be about the working class and things like that and middle class. I think there's also some bigoted people on the Trump supporter side, mm-hmm. don't get me wrong, but I think it gets a bad rep in the sense that I think there's things that there's much more common ground, I think, than mm-hmm. people suppose. Mm-hmm. Like if I was a politician, I would be focused on like, oh yes, we can agree on there are certain things in the past that everyone can look back fondly on, or there are certain ways that we've let our poor and middle-class people down, you know, things like that. I think there's just a lot of common ground, and it kind of, the very polarized nature of our society makes, if one group has this thing, then the other group has to be against it kind of tendency, you know, and I just mm-hmm. don't think that needs to apply. And I think politicians do themselves a disservice, you know, by not trying to bring people together more and say, oh, there are these things that we all really want.
Yeah. And we all have in common. I think, yeah, it's been, for me, so I'm Canadian, but it's been, but I've been here through the election cycle. And I during the last one, and also I was in Minnesota doing my dissertation, I think, both times Obama got elected, and it wasn't so much then, but I realize now it's much more polarized than it's ever been. But for me, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just an observer. But it feels like everything is so polarized.
I figured I'd do the podcast wrap up here, but if you're interested in psychology research, you might want to stick around for another minute to hear about some other interesting work she's done. She's done research on how there are ways you can manipulate people's experiences to make them continue to enjoy pleasant but repetitious experiences. For example, like eating the same meal many times in a row. If you'd like to learn more about Janine Lassaletta's work, you can check out her Google Scholar page. Her last name is spelled Lassaletta. My name is Zachary Elwood. If you'd like to learn more about this podcast and read summaries of past episodes, go to behavior-podcast.com. If you like the podcast, I very much appreciate a rating or review on iTunes. That's greatly appreciated, as are shares on social media. I make no money on this podcast and spend a good amount of time on it, so any help you can give me getting the word out there is much appreciated. If you'd like to learn more about existential psychology, which I think explains so much about our world and people's behaviors, I hugely recommend the book Existential Psychotherapy by Irvin Yalom, Y-A-L-O-M. I can't say enough good things about that book. Personally, I found it a life-changing book. Okay, let's go back to Janine explaining some of her other psychology work.
So the one thing that I wanted to talk, like that I thought was really cool that I've done, and that has nothing to do with nostalgia, I have a paper on consumption, like hedonic consumption. So it's the enjoyment, like the drop in enjoyment after repeated consumption. So it could be, you know, so say I eat strawberry yogurt every single day for breakfast. Over time, people get sick of it. Their enjoyment for eating strawberry yogurt decreases. So what are things that you can do to, you know, prolong that enjoyment, you know, like to kind of make that slope that's going down, to make it a little bit,
get the magic back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Zachary, like if you ate strawberry yogurt every morning for breakfast, and you're getting sick of it, what's one thing that you could do to make it make you
take a break and come back to it, go cold turkey?
Actually, what my work shows is that when you kind of take a break cold turkey, it really doesn't help it that much, because when you come back to it, you just think about all the strawberry yogurts you've eaten. But I think one thing that people usually would suggest, the research suggests, is that like you would eat blueberry yogurt, you know, like Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. So when you come back to the strawberry yogurt, you're like, yeah, you know, I had strawberry yogurt, but I also had blueberry yogurt. So the strawberry, I'm not so sick of the strawberry yogurt, right? So there's all this work that shows when we increase variety, you know, people have better, you know, like for the whatever the focal product is, people's enjoyment will be prolonged. So and there's like tons of studies in the marketing research academic marketing research that shows this. But I was thinking, you know, when I was in my PhD, I was like, well, is this always true, right? Like I thought about, like, if we follow this logic, we should try to make our experiences, so what you eat for breakfast every single morning, as different as possible to prolong enjoyment for a certain product. So if the focal product is strawberry yogurt, we should eat blueberry yogurt every other day. So if you follow the logic that all the research has shown, it would probably be the best thing to like eat something so different, right? So like maybe eating a piece of pizza, you know, or like a breakfast burrito, like Tuesday, Thursday, Friday would be the best. But what ends up happening is that when our experiences are so different, we don't put them in the same consideration set. So when we think about that strawberry yogurt, and say you did have the breakfast burrito or the, you know, pizza, you have like endless pizza around, but, you know, when we think about, we don't consider the pizza or the breakfast burrito in the same consumption
category.
Yeah. So it's all about, go ahead.
Oh, so you're saying you need something different enough, but in the same category in order to reset your appreciation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So what I found in my work is that when experiences are categorically different, if people like the natural categorization is different, it actually benefits us when we make the experiences more similar. So I would say, maybe the burrito, I would emphasize, you know, the breakfast burrito, just like all the other breakfast items I've eaten, you know? And I found that,
So the framing can really,
matter. Yeah. So basically that's what we just frame different things. So we had people come into the lab and they chose their favorite chocolate. So Hershey Kisses or like Rolos or those, you know, small Reese's peanut butter cups. And it was a taste test. And we just asked them to eat one and then rate their enjoyment. And then every so often they would have to eat oyster crackers, like two oyster crackers. And in one condition we said, oh, you'll eat oyster crackers as a break, as a palate cleanser. And then the other condition we said, you'll eat oyster crackers, which is another type of snack food.
So when we
told them that oyster crackers was another type of snack food, the drop in enjoyment was much less, right, than people that were told that, you know, well, this is a palate cleanser.
Oh, so you're saying, you're saying when you went from one snack food and framed the oyster crackers in between as another type of snack food, when they went back to that first thing, they didn't see the drop off because they enjoyed something in the same category, but that was different enough. Yeah.
There's a drop off in both, but the drop off was much less. So basically these studies, it's the same kind of dependent variable. It's like, eat this piece of chocolate on the scale from 0 to 100. How much do you enjoy it? 0, not at all. 100, I really enjoy it. So every time they eat the chocolate, they rate it, and it will always drop, but it drops less when we tell them that the cracker is also another type of snack food. And we found the same thing with, we had people listen to Haydn, like a 30-second clip over and over again. And every so often we put nature sounds and we tell them, we're going to listen to nature sounds every so often, or we're going to listen to nature sounds. And studies have shown that the classical music reflects like nature sounds. And we found the same thing. We did the same thing with, like, we had people listen to like U2 song, maybe With or Without You or something. And every so often they would see Gustav Klimt's The Kiss. So it was two modalities, right? It was like listening to music and then seeing art. And then sometimes we're like, oh, you'll see this image every so often. And then we said, you'll see this image every so often. And we posed it in a way that it was also maybe about love or something. I forget now, but we saw the same
similar framing.
Yeah. Similar framing. And we also saw the same thing when, we also had another condition, and basically the other condition didn't have any Gustav Klimt, and the drop in enjoyment for the condition that had no Gustav Klimt and the one that had Gustav Klimt, but we didn't say it was similar to Gustav, to you two, the drop was exactly the same. So people are ignoring that variety until you tell them it's similar enough. So
that seems like it has, it seems like it has would have big applications to anything marketing related, anything experiential, or anything food related, or anything, even, you know, restaurants or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or even like astronauts, you know, like,
oh,
you know,
right.
They only have a certain amount of food. Right. And I think, the professor I was working with, my colleague now, you know, I think he was on, he did some work looking at how to increase, you know, the enjoyment for food that you're just eating basically over and over again, because you're in space, you know? Yeah, so that's, I mean, something I think is really cool, but I didn't really prepare, so I don't know how useful it is. But I think it's, like, for the podcast, but I think, and it hasn't gotten as much traction. The nostalgia one always gets so much traction, you know?
Mm-hmm. People love nostalgia,
People love nostalgia, and it's really easy. When you're nostalgic, you care about money less. Boom, you know?
Yeah.
And this one is, like, you know, it's really hard.
It's subtle.
To, like, it's subtle, and it's, like, moderately similar, but you know, you hit it right on the head at the beginning. It's, there's like an optimal level of, you know, differentiation in terms of, you know, what prolongs enjoyment. So that's something, but
yeah, well, it's interesting thinking about the implications of that. There's probably a lot of uses for that of various sorts. Yeah, I can see why you're interested in that. Yeah. This has been the People Who Read People podcast. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Music by Small Skies.